We've just caught up with Donald Runicles. That was a wonderful Mozart. Bravo.
Oh, I'll tell the orchestra. I do very little in that. It's a piece of perfection, that symphony. One of my favorites. Not programmed that often. But what this orchestra does with it is very special. And I take no credit. It's their supreme music making with one another. It's chamber music on a slightly larger scale. And as I say, I just get to stand up in front of it and enjoy them.
Well, it's interesting because it does sound like chamber music on a larger scale. At the time Mozart was writing this, I understand he was 18 and was going back and forth to Italy. Are there evidences of his Italian trips in this symphony?
Nothing specific. It's a joyous work. I suppose you can say it's the Italian influences in the Menuetto, the third movement, which was then the tradition, the minuet and trio. No, I think its joy is more of a universal joy. It's this delicious, delightful second movement. It's really, that's why we have music. Where, you know, music starts where words stop. It's very hard to convey my just awe at how this, and he probably wrote it in 15 minutes, as we know. It just poured out of him. Today you press print, you know, and it just, the whole symphony comes out. And that's rather what happened with these works. It's a colossal achievement.
Does Mozart illustrate some of the historical connection between opera and symphonic music? He was writing operas at the same time he was writing symphonies. And I understand that sometimes overtures to operas were then remade into symphonies. Is that right?
Well, I think he, this goes all the way back to Johann Sebastian Bach, where he would reuse material from a cantata. It would find its way into a mass in B minor. Similarly, Mozart would take pieces that were written for other occasions. I mean, it's always worth remembering that very, very few of these works were written just because he felt like writing a symphony. I mean, it was existential. He needed money. He needed to be commissioned to write a concerto or a symphony, or even an opera. Few are the symphonies and few are the concertos where, for instance, the piano concertos, which he played himself, where he just wrote it because he had the need to write it. And therefore, he and the composers of those days were probably constantly under pressure to be providing their count or their countess or their duke or their duchess the work that was promised. And so, yes, they often use their own material. But the question about the operatic presence in music like this, I think some of Mozart's most wonderful music can be found in the operas. I feel that the opera, the voice just fascinated him. He writes so consummately for the human voice. And in these symphonies, once again, you could imagine so many of these themes being sung. They're like arias. And he was, I would say, that a little like Richard Strauss in some ways, which we'll hear now after the intermission. Richard Strauss wrote phenomenal symphonic works, symphonic poems. I think, though, the human voice, though, the opera was for him the Everest. That was what he enjoyed doing the most. In fact, we know that for him, his all-time hero was Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. He worked very hard to write the perfect opera. He wanted to write the modern day, or in his day, the Marriage of Figaro. And so I think Richard Strauss had a very similar relationship to Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, in as far as the opera was the non plus ultra, and everything else somehow fed off that.
And you've talked about your fascination with the human voice. And when you spent 10 years in Germany as a young adult, you were exploring your Wagnerian disposition. What does that mean?
Exploring my Wagnerian disposition. Well, the music of Richard Wagner has accompanied me my entire life. I was taken as a boy in my music class at school. We had a very enlightened music teacher who took us to Glasgow, which is on the west coast of Scotland, to hear the first Ring cycle ever in Scotland. And I heard Das Rheingold. And I can say that, hand on heart, it changed my life. I heard that music. I had the singular impression that this hand, this arm reached out at me and took me by the throat and dragged me willingly into the sound world of Richard Wagner. And I was, this was, what was I? I was 16 at the time. And that really did. I mean, that as much as the music of Gustav Mahler, that kind of also was a natural progression. But the music, the sound world of Richard Wagner was a world that I wanted to live in all the time. And that's where my, where things, all things Wagnerian, getting to Germany, then coaching all the big roles in Wagner, then eventually conducting them. It was something of a business card for me that it led to my appointment in Freiburg in Southwest Germany, 4 years. It was a Flying Dutchman that led to that. I became music director in San Francisco after two Ring cycles in 1990. In Berlin, where I am now, at the Deutsche Oper Berlin, it was a Ring cycle in 2007, which then led to my appointment there as music director. So the music of Richard Wagner most certainly informs my everyday.
It's a leitmotif in your life.
It most certainly is a leitmotif, yes. And this love affair, this fascination with this man's music has not in any way diminished. I'm still fascinated by this. And in Berlin, we're planning through 2020, 2021, finally a new Ring cycle. You have to plan that far in advance. And it's topical in as far as, who knows, were it not for this man and this revolution in music, harmonically, orchestrally, you wouldn't have perhaps heard a Don Juan, or you wouldn't have experienced Richard Strauss's Don Juan the way it is, because Wagner had this just vast influence on all things musical around him. It was this watershed in musical history, and it's very clear when you listen to this precociously brilliant work, Don Juan, that Richard Strauss had immersed himself as well in the music and the sound world of Richard Wagner and taken it and made it his own.
And it was also done when he was a very young man, 24.
Oh, outrageously young. I mean, you know, just this, and there are some wonderful comparisons, though. Richard Strauss, this young genius, a little like the young Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. But there the similarity ends, because, of course, Mozart died at a tragically young age, and Richard Strauss almost outlived he literally outlived his generation, but also musically, he lived to a ripe old age and was something of an exile in his own musical country when he, you know, 1948, when he finally died. And gosh, don't we lead fascinating lives?
Yes, and I understand that this Don Juan is somewhat autobiographical. He was trying to put a positive spin on the whole Don Juan thing.
Autobiographical. He was clearly a very attractive and charismatic young man. But for all the philandering that may be integral to this, the Don Juan legend and the sensuality and the seduction, it's a wonderful fact that Richard Strauss met his wife, Pauline, very early on in his life. She was a singer, and she had most certainly a very strong personality. And they remained happily married their entire lives. It was, which has less to do with Don Juan.
And in between the Strauss and the Mozart, we have the Brahms double concerto for both violin and cello. Brahms wrote this at a time when there weren't many of concerti written for multiple instruments. Is that right?
Yes, it's a rare beast. Very few works written for violin and cello. Of course, a great deal of chamber music written for a trio, so to speak, violin, cello, and piano, but very rarely a work written for violin, cello, and orchestra. It's actually a very interesting and rather remarkable fact that this work hasn't been played in a subscription concert here in Philadelphia in 20 years. It doesn't feature that often. It's an extremely hard and challenging and wonderful work, and it's personally a wonderful experience working with David and Haye. Obviously, I've worked with them as leader of the orchestra and as solo cellist. So to work with them now as soloists, no pressure, of course, when these remarkable musicians are playing in front of their own orchestra. It's quite glorious. And as I say, it's technically a very, very difficult piece to play. But you'll hear it.
And this whole second half really showcases musicians in the orchestra, the Don Juan as well.
Oh, yes. It's a virtuosic work, astonishingly virtuosic. And I mean by that, it's although it's a work that is played a great deal, particularly by this orchestra, it makes it no less hard to play. It's quite a, this technically, Strauss was pushing all of the instruments in the orchestra to their limit, from the bass, the double bass in the orchestra, all the way up to the flutes and to the harps, the famous horn calls in that work. We know them, we love them. If I had one regret, it would be not to have been at the first performance of this piece, because I just, like so many of the great works that we know and love, I would love to have heard that for the very first time. I mean, I do remember the very first time I heard it. It was a recording with Fritz Reiner and the Chicago Symphony, which I think was made in something like 1953 or 1954 on one of these RCA Victrola records. I couldn't stop hearing the piece. I couldn't stop listening to the piece. And so here I am, many years later, at the helm of one of the world's greatest, most distinguished, most remarkable orchestras, conducting this repertoire and thinking, what a privileged life I lead.
You must have a really fascinating perspective now, because you make music in different parts of the world, in different settings, with different orchestras, different audiences, different musicians for making music.
They certainly straddle different continents, but I would say my approach is exactly the same wherever I am. I have the great pleasure of working with these remarkable musicians, whether they're in Scotland, whether they're in Berlin, whether they're in Wyoming, whether they're in Atlanta, whether they're in Philadelphia. It's fun, incidentally, working as the music director of the Grand Teton Music Festival. Those who don't know it, it's one of the finest festivals in the country. Terrific players come from all our orchestras. David Kim, the leader of the Philadelphia Orchestra, came for the very first time this year and led the orchestra, and he's eager to get back. So we have really these top-notch players who come together to create this orchestra over 7 weeks. And that for me is a symbol of the international language that we all speak, that is music. And therefore, of course, it's interesting working with the German orchestra, their strengths, their challenges, working with an American orchestra, different sound worlds perhaps, different traditions, some orchestras steeped in the Romantic repertoire, other orchestras less steeped. But I would say that my approach to music making on whatever side of the pond is the same. One is always looking to dig deeper. What were the composer's intentions? I do feel now, particularly as you mentioned, I have these different relationships with different organizations. For me, it's all about the relationship. Much as I love being here, guest conducting is something that I do less now. For me, it's digging deeper. It's building on the relationship with an orchestra or with an organization in a holistic sense. Yeah, I suppose I have a lot of miles and more. I have a lot of frequent flyer miles because of all the travel I do. But each time it's like coming home to a different kind of home.
Well, welcome home again. We're glad you're here. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.